This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi. This is Q, the podcast. Highlights from the November 15th edition of Q, the program. Okay, on your podcast today, Steve Earle, the country rock troubadour and passionate political voice, returns with a more personal new record, Washington Square Serenade. He's my guest live in Studio Q. And are Brangelina and Bono and Ginger Spice really helping the world? We look at celebrity diplomacy with Andrew Cooper. He's written a new book on the subject. Plus, we go north to Whitehorse to look at the demise of the Caribou Records label and the hole it leaves in the Yukon music scene. North of 60 as well, or north of 62. This is Q. He's a Grammy Award-winning musician who's been called one of the greatest living songwriters in America, emerging on the scene with his debut album, Guitar Town, in 1986 after years of composing songs for other artists. He helped to usher in a renaissance in country rock. His new album, this is his 12th, as I say, is called Washington Square Serenade. He's also a musician, as I've also said, who's an outspoken citizen on an opponent of capital punishment, the war in Iraq, the Bush administration. I'm talking about Steve Earle, and he joins me live in Studio Q. Hello.
How are you?
Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
It's a pleasure. That song, City of Immigrants, I'm assuming you're talking about New York City.
Yeah, but it could be Toronto, and it could be, you know, Los Angeles, and it could be, you know, a lot of places. I mean, I think...
Could be a lot of places in Canada.
A whole lot of places in Canada. I think that's one sort of impressive thing about Canada, because the population's more concentrated in the cities. As you go all the way across the country, you know, you see this sort of mirror image of the United States, where south of the border, by the time you get to the middle of the country, you know, things get pretty white. And it's, you know, those people were originally immigrants as well. You know, the upper Midwest was settled originally, you know, by Swedes and Norwegians and Germans. But it is what it is now. And there's been much more of people arriving in Canada and then, you know, like jumping from one city to the next.
We have the highest immigration rate in the world.
That makes perfect sense to me.
Speaking of that middle part of the country, that's sort of where you come from or have you used to live and where you're born.
Right.
Now you live in New York City. This record feels like a love letter to New York City.
It's love songs to Alison Moore in New York City is largely what it is. It's not... A lot of things happen in my life. I mean, you know, I made Jerusalem and then I made The Revolution Starts Now, and they're kind of part one and part two of the same record. They're like me engaging politically. I mean, there were personal things in both of those records, but they are overtly political records. I mean, my work has always been political to a certain extent. Copperhead Road's a pretty political record. You know, it's my reaction along with the rest of the people in my country to post-traumatic stress around the Vietnam War. We all grew up with it, and it took a long time for people to start talking and writing and making art about it. So Copperhead was my post-Vietnam record. But I needed a personal record. I needed to take care of some business, you know, emotionally and personally, and I needed to move to New York City because I'd been in Nashville for 30 years and realized it's a beautiful place, but it's also someplace I was able to live just being me for 30 years, mainly because I wasn't there very much. And I needed to open my door and walk outside and see like a mixed-race, same-sex couple holding hands, because after everything we've been through the last, you know, 8 years anyway, it makes me feel safer somehow in my neighborhood.
And you're loving living in it. I should mention, you say this is a personal record, and you mentioned Alison. She's not only, she also sings and performs on this record, but you might just explain who she is.
Alison,
record's dedicated to her.
Yeah, it's you know, Alison Moore, who's a great singer. I am overmarried in every way you can possibly imagine. She's smarter than I am. She's a lot better looking than I am. And she's a lot better singer than I am. And she's all over this record, and it's She's got a great record of her own coming out in January, and we spent the last few years of our lives, part of moving to New York was us having a place of our own that neither one of us had really any history and we hadn't lived before, and New York's new to both of us, so we're getting to sort of learn our way around it together, and I think that's been huge.
We hear so much about the United States, about your country being a divided country, polarized mm-hmm. to the extreme. And I wonder if moving from Nashville, even symbolically, given that you weren't spending that much time, as you say, in Nashville, but moving from Nashville to New York feels like moving from one America to another America.
Well, it does. I mean, who is it? Somebody did say, call it once an island off the coast of America. I actually, and it is that, but I am a huge proponent of the idea, just growing up where I grew up, that the United States is not America. Canada is America. Mexico is America. And you know, I've always realized that. And I think a lot of
what does that mean?
It means that this is, you know, people came from Europe, you know, originally and settled America. And over, you know, due to politics, you know, it got divided up a certain way. And all of a sudden, you know, because of a series of accidents and mainly climate, the middle of this landmass on this side became dominant. And that's all it is. It's an accident. Canada ended up being Canada and the U.S. ended up being the U.S. And then they sort of put all of what they refer to as Latin America on ice. Well, we'll save those natural resources for later. And just, oh, they're getting a little too independent. It looks kind of socialist down there. We need to intervene. And that's been, you know, the U.S. dominating politics for a long time. I heard somebody say that Canada could be the most powerful country in the world because people are killing each other over water right now. And like 2/3 of the fresh water in this hemisphere is in Canada. But when somebody says that, I think, well, that's really great because there's something about I spent a lot of time here, and I think I probably understand, you know, the difference between Canadians and people from the U.S., you know, than a lot of people.
Back to this idea of the divided America and moving from one to another. And you, are you suggesting subtly that New York is part of Canada?
No, I'm suggesting that
symbolically.
I'm suggesting that Canada is part of the rest of the world, and that New York is part of the rest of the world, and maybe Cleveland's not. Mm. You know, it's
how
not.
How do Americans react to you saying that?
Well, I mean, I don't know, and I obviously
you
at this point it's a little late to care. You know, it's one of those things. I mean, I could have, you know, kept my mouth shut about certain things and probably sold more records than I've sold. I still sell more records per capita in Canada. Than
no, but on this specific point, I mean, you're someone, you really have bridged the gap in some ways. You are a guy who, part of what's refreshing about you is that, you know, middle America or the South or whomever, the country scene, that they trusted you
right, or
they understood you. And I'm just curious what the reaction is to you being a New York guy now who says the kind of things you just
said.
Well,
I mean, I don't know, because I mean, this is the first record that I've made since I moved to New York. But keep in mind, you know, I think that from outside the country, it's very easy to overestimate who my audience is. I mean, there are people that do listen to me in the middle of the country that wouldn't listen to maybe someone with a different accent than I've got. That's true to a certain extent, but it's also, I'm a pretty well-known pinko at this point. I mean, it's like the Dixie Chicks thing. Like Natalie said what she said at Shepherd's Bush Empire, which is my home in London for the last 10 years, is where I've performed more than any other venue in town. And 10 nights later, I mean, you know, that whole thing broke out within 24 hours. But it says 10 nights later, I was in the same place. I walked out on stage in a T-shirt that said F the War, only the other stuff after the F was on the T-shirt as well. And it, you know, I made page 3 of The Guardian. It was like, it was expected from me. And right. It wasn't, that's what people were upset about, was Natalie made the comment that she made as a mother and as a country musician, as one of the biggest acts in country music. And a lot of people felt betrayed. And, you know, I think the real issue for me was, at the time, was what are artists qualified to comment on? And, you know, in other words, this idea that artists aren't qualified to comment on the society they live in. I don't really care what Britney Spears has to say about politics, but I'm not Britney Spears. And I was raised doing this at a certain level where politics do count.
I'm glad that's a perfect segue, because that's exactly what I want to ask you about. I'm really curious about, because you were very involved in the 2004 elections in the U.S.
Yeah,
so,
I was.
The Kerry campaign. And I, Steve, I want your perspective.
As much as I could be, trust me, I mean, you know, Democratic candidates are like, I mean, sometimes if I'm supporting a Democratic candidate, sometimes the best thing I can do is stay as far away from him as possible.
But when you say you're well-known,
somewhat more radical,
maybe. But I mean, when you say well-known pinko, that's by American standards, right? I mean,
well, I am.
You're a liberal, right? Are you not?
I'm a socialist who lives in a country with no viable socialist party, and because we don't have a true parliamentary, what I consider to be a true democratic. You know, I mean, look, the same corporations and the same powerful entities are arrayed against you in Canada, but you do have a shot. You do have a form of government that makes some form of real democracy at least possible if all the planets line up. There's two sides of the aisle for a reason, and not that much difference from the rest of the world's perspective between the two parties in my country.
Here's my question for you. 2004, in terms of the intervention of the arts community, you... many others, Springsteen, Madison, Wisconsin, thousands of people supporting John Kerry. Is it possible to say it didn't work? The Bush administration was reelected. I'm wondering what you believe the arts community, maybe not Britney Spears, but those of you who want to be spoken out and think you can make a difference, should do this time.
I do defend Britney Spears' right to say anything about anything. I'm just not promising I'll listen. But the difference, there's a big difference between artists like that who don't want any part of it. But I grew up, I learned to write songs in coffee houses in the 60s and 70s. It never occurred to me to separate issues and art. But
what's the way forward? That's what
is to keep doing what you're doing. I think we made a big difference in the election. I think the Bush administration, given the climate, would have walked completely over with no questions being asked. And it was still, both of these elections were close. A very small number of people. There were definitely something happened in the first election that wasn't kosher. And you can assume that there are some votes that weren't, quite kosher in the second, just based on the first one. I mean, if it happened one time, why didn't it happen again? In fact, the problem is that a lot of people in the country were okay with it happening. They were so scared that they really didn't, it got down to the question of when all they had to say was, well, there hasn't been an attack since September 11th. Mm. And that's what people, but I think a lot of people, it's not about, it's not about right-wing people or the Christian right or any of that stuff. It's about people that were potential Democratic voters that I think in the long run were afraid, and at the last minute they didn't tell any of their friends. They may have even been at the Springsteen concert the night before, but then when Election Day came, they walked into the booth, and because it's private, they felt safer voting for Bush, and they reelected him. Very narrow margin.
Where's your mindset in terms of, are you optimistic? There's a song on this record called Steve's Hammer. Mm-hmm. It's a reference to Pete Seeger's.
Pete Seeger and us.
And in the song you say you're looking forward to a time when you don't have to be angry, where you don't have to be protesting. And I wonder if you think that time is nigh, or if that's a dream world for you.
I don't know whether I'm looking forward to it as much as I'm answering the question, when are you going to just shut up and sing? And the answer to it is, when there isn't any hunger, and when there isn't any pain, and when there isn't any war, and when unions are taken for granted, when we don't have to worry about whether workers have a right to say something about their work environment,
let alone watching reruns on TV with the writer's strike, right?
Yeah. Well, no, it's one of those deals. I'm on a television show, I just did the last season of a show called The Wire, and it was created by writers, so it's a tough thing right now because everybody's, trying to work. But I didn't, I was in LA when the strike started, and I was supposed to go out for meetings with these music coordinators, and I don't cross picket lines, and I didn't cross that one. So I can have those meetings later on after the strike.
Man, I have so much to ask you. I want to ask you about The Wire. But our time is short, and I do want to get to a song from your record. I will ask you this in terms of, because I think a lot of people are walking around sort of thinking, what is going on in your country? The dollar is slipping. Nobody seems to know what to do about the war.
Justice.
A writer's strike.
Grey's
Anatomy is in reruns. I mean, So I guess I want to know what you think. I think the mood is, it's interesting, we did a chat a couple of days ago on this show about the fact that there's this spate of war movies coming out, or movies about the war, so many of them from a liberal perspective,
right?
The new Robert Redford one,
right.
Brian De Palma's is out this Friday, and Americans to a certain extent are not going to them. They're not going to see these films,
Well, that's interesting. That's the first I've heard about it. That's probably true. I think that for me, I'm the wrong guy to ask in a lot of ways, because I don't have a problem with the idea that this moment that that's been going on all my life, where America was without question the most powerful country in the world, I'm kind of sick of it. I'm kind of sick of being the guy that has to travel around and talk to audiences and meet people from all over the world and answer all those questions, because I'm not that. I'm not that attitude, that monolithic, you know, American, you know, the ugly American. I'm not that guy. I wasn't raised to be that guy, and I've never been that. So you know, the biggest difference between Western Europe and most of the United States is most of those countries have been the most powerful country in the world for at least 30 seconds. Even Holland was the most powerful country in the world for about 6 months. And it's they know that there's life after that. Unfortunately, because of this last little version of empire that we've endured with the U.S. at the helm, there's some frighteningly American-looking things happening all over the world, including in Canada. Don't take it for granted that you know, I always tell audiences when I play here, do not forget to be Canadian. That is something. It does mean something, and it separates you from people in my country, and it makes a difference, especially in our future, because our moment may be over, and I'm okay with that.
For all this talk of America and the political situation, I actually, to send you off here, I want to actually play a song from your record that's probably not a political song, but it's my favorite on the record. It's a personal song called "Come Home to Me." You set this up for us
It was funny. It's one of those things where you can expand what life is to make it, you know, a broader theme than it really is. It sounds like a big breakup song or like somebody left somebody. Actually, what happened is, Allison went to Nashville for, you know, like a week or something to work on something she needed. You know, our work stays together most of the time, but all of a sudden it didn't, and we were apart for about 4 or 5 days, and what the end result was this.
It's a pleasure to have you here, man. Always interesting to hear your thoughts, and thanks for this new record.
Cool. We'll be back in March.
This is Q, the podcast, with Gian Gameschi from CBC Radio 1.
Well, whether it's AIDS in Africa, debt forgiveness, or Darfur, no A-list celebrity would be caught dead these days without that essential accessory. The global issue. For some people, all this celebrity photo-opping and speechifying can start to ring a little hollow, just a little. Think of, say, Jerry Halliwell, a.k.a. Ginger Spice, in her role as UN ambassador.
You know, I'm very optimistic, and I'm going to do my best for this UN job and, you know, and try and really make it work, and hopefully, you know, my solo career will make it work.
Hopefully it will. Girl power goes global. But consider this, at the same time as our cynicism, Bono gets meetings with global leaders that prime ministers and presidents can't get. That includes Canada's prime minister, by the way. And Bill Gates spends more on health each year than the World Health Organization. Such observations got our next guest, an expert in diplomacy, thinking about star power. In his new book called Celebrity Diplomacy, Andrew Cooper admits there's reasons to be cynical, but he also says that celebrities are worth taking seriously in their diplomatic roles. They might even be usurping the pros. And he joins me now in Studio Q. Hello, Andrew.
Thanks, Jan. Pleasure to be
no
here.
No entourage?
No entourage today. Ginger Spice was busy.
You've learned nothing from the celebrities, it seems, so far, in terms of the posse. You need the posse.
Well, it shows the range, I think, in your introduction, from the faddish, the facile, to the very serious.
Well, let's get into that. You, first of all, you're a professor of political science at University of Waterloo. Why did you want to look into celebrities?
Well, one of the reasons was not only do I teach at University of Waterloo, but I'm with a new think tank, CG, and we wanted to do topics that were accessible to the population, and celebrities, of course, are extremely accessible.
Were you interested in celebrity culture, celebrity gossip, celebrities' goings and comings before you got involved in this?
Well, I think I snuck a look at the rack of celebrity magazines at the counters. But I think going back even 10 years, it's Princess Diana that really got me going, that something was happening in the celebrity world. Got me going in terms of photos, that on landmines, all of a sudden, the photos that were taken of her in Angola mobilized, was a catalyst for action. And, of course, the success of the Landmines Initiative.
Now, and as you say, in your book. I mean, even though this is, I guess this would be a time in history where celebrity diplomacy, if we want to call it that, has been is greater than it's ever been. But it's not entirely new. If we think back to even Lawrence of Arabia or Benjamin Franklin, there's always people of big names or recognizable figures getting involved in issues.
But in those days, usually they were in some purpose for national interest or a national state. And I think what we're finding now is free floaters, people that have even extended from the UN system. Audrey Hepburn, of course, was a classic example back in the 1980s and early 90s. But we find now people sort of going off freelancing.
Now, you're not wholly critical of what you're calling celebrity diplomacy. What kind of role has celebrity diplomacy come to play on the world stage, do you think?
Symbolically, to make global governance issues accessible, to make them feel that people can do things and make a difference. And of course, when you have bite and buzz, you can do that. The entertainers provide the buzz. Many of the material-oriented people, Bill Gates, George Soros, and so on, provide the bite.
And in a nutshell, you think this is effective?
Well, it's very effective, you know, and you can go down the list. And surprising list, Mia Farrow, for instance, on Darfur. Lots of people trying to get UN troops, African Union troops into Darfur. She links it with China, with the Chinese Beijing Olympics, and all of a sudden you have movement.
You mentioned the UN a couple of times. The United Nations seems to be an organization with an A-list ambassador in every department. Do they have a celebrity fetish? Is this a concerted campaign where they decided this is what they're going to do?
Some people said that Kofi Annan had a fetish for celebrities until one day he walked down the hall and didn't recognize some of the people that were celebrity ambassadors, and perhaps he realized that he'd gone too far.
Right.
And of course, part of the problem was the ginger spice issue. In your tape, Ginger Spice is sent off to the Philippines as an ambassador on population issues. And of course, the Catholic Church in the Philippines, she was just over her head on those sort of issues.
How does the UN react when somebody, as you say, is over their head? Is there shame, embarrassment? Do they slap anybody's wrist? What happens?
There's embarrassment, but there's also mentorship. And Angelina Jolie is a good example of that. They knew that they had somebody really attractive in Angelina, but at the same time, they knew that if they just let Angelina loose right from the start, that she would be a ginger spice.
I want to get to Angelina in a second, but first of all, this new wave of celebrity diplomacy, who was the first of this new brand of stars tackling world issues? Would you say it was Diana?
In terms of that catalytic notion, Audrey Hepburn, I think, stands out, but very conformist. She does things that looking back, set the trend. She was on Larry King. She raised money. She was in the front lines. But she didn't really have an edge to her. Diana did have an edge. She was quite a rebel in terms of diplomatic
status.
How
did the rebel express itself?
Because she had been sort of frustrated in being an ambassador, a freelance ambassador for the British government. And she realized that the route was NGOs. So Red Cross, HALO, a number of those organizations, and all of a sudden they knew how to use her.
To the point where she put noses out of joint?
Oh, very much in the conservative establishment, yes. Loose cannon, I think, was the word that they used for her.
Well, not all stars are created equal. In the book, you describe Sophie Loren showing up for her appointment as UN ambassador in a Rolls-Royce and first fur coat, perhaps a bit out of touch with her role. But there's a whole galaxy of stars out there these days working on some of the most crucial issues of our time. Let me play a few clips, and we'll ask you to give us the lowdown on these on how these celebrities rank. Let's start with somebody you just mentioned.
And I asked her what would have happened to him, or what's happened to him, or what could be done. And found out that they said he was probably just going to die because of the reality of how many people were in that situation. And he was alone, and he was really scared, and he was just a kid.
Well, that's Angelina Jolie talking about one of her first experiences as a UN ambassador in Sierra Leone. What's your take on Angelina?
Angelina, in some ways, is an Audrey Hepburn on steroids. I mean, Audrey Hepburn sort of kept to the script. But it was very emotional, very press media oriented, and of course Angelina Jolie has gone beyond that, and of course gone beyond the United Nations. There's a sort of a diffuse sense of Angelina that she's everywhere: Chechnya, Sierra Leone, Pakistan, on earthquakes. But at the same time, she's becoming part of the establishment. She's in on the Council on Foreign Relations now, the ultimate sort of establishment post for foreign policy.
I think with someone like Angelina, I guess part of the cynicism is that people think she's just such a big star. Yep. It's nice that she cares, but you know, in what way is she qualified yep. to be leading? You know, in what way does she know the path that we should be following in terms of, say, third world issues, etc.?
Exactly, and I think there's two lines on this. One is she can hire very good help. And she has done that. She's got a lot of very keen, very expert advisors. But at the same time, with Angelina, there's almost a sense that there's going to be an embarrassment or disaster at some point. And I think one of the interesting features is that it hasn't happened so far.
No,
she hasn't been a ginger spice. She might have that in her personal life, but in her public life, she's been very solid.
All right. Well, in that case, let's throw something different at you. When you say she's been very solid, you might not be talking about this person. Here you go.
It gave me, you know, a time out in life just to really find out what is important and what I want to do, figuring out who I am. Even though it was really hard, I took that time just to get to know myself. I have a new outlook on life.
That is Paris Hilton, her first interview on Larry King after leaving jail earlier this year. As part of her new outlook on life, she signed on for a goodwill mission to Rwanda, which we learned recently has been postponed. The plan was to film the visit and try to sell it as a reality TV show called The Philanthropist, with not just Paris but other celebs, like The Simple Life moves to Rwanda. Is this the kind of thing that's a helpful development, Andrew?
No, I don't think Rwanda is ready for Paris Hilton. You know, This is a devastated country from 1994, you know, with the genocide. And I think there's been so many good people working on reconstruction of Rwanda. Indeed, some celebrities. Ziggy Marley has been in the region, obviously using his father's potential. But at the same time, Paris Hilton has no mentorship, no credentials, no sort of expertise in this area.
But how are we supposed to know? I mean, you know, it is, I guess, both kind of easy to pick on Paris Hilton. But really, I mean, how do we know if she's any less or more qualified than Angelina Jolie? I mean, isn't this part of the problem that there's we call them all celebrities, and so how can we pick and choose the ones we think are credible?
Well, I think this is one of the reasons I decided to write the book. You know, I sort of wanted to sort of trace that not all celebrities are equal when they get into this activity. You know, there are the Paris Hiltons, there are the Ginger Spices, but there's also the Bonos and the Bill Gates and the Soroses and so on. And you've got to make a choice, you know, whether you want the sort of faddish, or do you want somebody, you know, or a set of people that are going to go on and do not always effective things, but serious things.
Okay, well, you said his name, so at last one, you know, we had to play this guy.
I've just come back from Africa. I've just seen what this money can do. They signed in their own handwriting, leaders of the 8 richest nations on earth. I asked for them to do it in their handwriting. They had never done it in their handwriting before, and they're still slithering out of it.
That's Bono talking to CNN about the latest G8 meeting. Later in that interview, Bono calls the meeting between President Bush and Russia's Vladimir Putin a complete distraction. Andrew, who's doing the distracting, the politicians or the rock stars?
Good question, and especially when he's with his co-partner, Bob Geldof. The two of them sort of act as good and bad cop in this regard. Bono is interesting, though, in this sense, because, of course, he's treated like a leader. He's helicoptered into the summits. He gets bilaterals with the big leaders that even the leaders of the smaller countries of the G8 don't get. He meets Bush. He meets Blair. He's met Sarkozy in the last G8 in Germany. I mean, this is a status that you wouldn't have expected from a celebrity.
You like Bono, don't you? You think he's doing good work.
I
get that from your book. Anyway.
I like Bono because I think there's more to Bono than Bono, in the sense that he's the only one that I think has built up an organization, data, that transcends that sort of personalism. Bono is in some ways a classic diplomat, and I make an allusion that in some ways he's the Kissinger of celebrity diplomacy.
He might not like that.
No, he might not like that. But he he's in some ways just as manipulative. And of course, we've seen this in the Canadian case. He manipulated, I think, Paul Martin. In some ways, he manipulated Stephen Harper at the last summit.
Well, did he, or did they? I mean, you know, he played the Liberal Party convention. I mean, did they manipulate him?
Well,
you know, on the basis of we'll do a couple of things for you. I mean, this is the question around Bono, right? Is shaking hands with George W. Bush and telling us that you got something in a backroom meeting worth it if what the leader is doing is something you oppose, right?
And initially, that's very much the case, and it's interesting the left in Britain has that view of Bono and of course Geldof, in the sense that they think he's in bed with the enemy, you know, and you see Bianca Jagger, for instance, you know, coming out time and time again being critical of those two, saying, you know, this takes away from the work that NGOs do, particularly, of course, the more sort of radical NGOs.
Not just the left NGOs. In Britain. I mean, Naomi Klein, of course, has come out recently and talking about the bonoization of issues and how,
exactly.
how it's a problem.
No, I use the phrase, you know, bonoization of diplomacy, because I think it is very much that perspective, that Bono is in some ways the hub of a network that we have to look at, both for the flaws and for some of the advantages.
Well, how do you get the advantages without the disadvantage? It's funny, when you talk about Bono, when I was doing Sounds Like Canada last summer, and I guess I made some comments about Bono that mm-hmm. were somewhat disparaging. I'm actually a big U2 fan, but but I felt like in the wake of Live 8 and everything, I just thought Bono was too much. And the audience response from across Canada was interesting because he's a really polarizing figure.
Yes.
Some people are quite, even U2 fans, are quite turned off by his omnipresence, you know, on these issues. And others think, well, you know, if he's trying to do something. One of the problems I have is that I don't think he should be advancing the great man theory. I mean, he seems to be considering himself some sort of messiah at times. And I don't know how that helps the world. If you know, we rely on Bono to save us all, you know,
exactly.
probably can't get everywhere in the world in time, right?
Well, there's a lot of issues on this. I mean, one, of course, like Angelina Jolie, starts mixing his day and night job very, very quickly and decisively. You know, he's on the stage. And, of course, he's been doing this for a long time, going back to the 1980s, where he did it on Central America. But I think what you find with Bono, and it fits in with your view, is that there's a fatigue factor with Bono. In some ways, he's been so successful as getting access, for getting his name and his perspectives onto the stage, literally, that people become a little tired. And in that sense, I think if celebrities diplomacy is going to go further, he's got to hand off to other people, both younger people and people in the South as well.
But if it's, I mean, some feel that people like Bono are actually better at the work than the professional diplomats. What does that say about the state of diplomacy? Or is it just that Bono should have been a diplomat and he happens to be a good rock star too?
Well, I think one of the problems with diplomacy is it's always been sort of a clubbish format, that diplomats deal with diplomats. And I think what Bono, and of course a lot of NGOs as well, they've broken that club model. They've moved into networks, and they see it as very fluid, very hybrid type of activity. And of course, from that perspective, diplomats can learn from Bono about public relations, about access, how do you get your messages across. And of course, I think if diplomats take public diplomacy seriously, which a lot of them do, not just in the West, but China, India, and so on, then they're going to have to use some of the same techniques.
But I understand moving public opinion or bringing attention, but do we want stars brokering international agreements?
This is the limit. And I don't think we see that many cases now. You know, in the past, you had, as you mentioned, Benjamin Franklin, that was an accredited diplomat. I think the test for celebrity diplomacy is whether they can sort of move from these global governance issues, health, debt, relief, and so on, and move into more sort of crisis-oriented. On Darfur, you're seeing some movement in that regard. But I think the limits are there. I don't think on North Korea, on Middle East, you're going to see too much celebrity action.
I mean, give me the concrete examples. Where it does work, where you think it does work, having Bono or Angelina Jolie talking about an issue somewhere in the world and actually having that translate in a solid way in terms of addressing an issue.
I think on health. I mean, your example before about the WHO. WHO was laggard. You know, there was a sense that he needed to sort of step up their game. And I think it's not only because of Bono and Bill Gates, but we've seen the WHO now stepping up and spending more money. And in a sense, trying to focus on these issues that most probably most people in the world, and certainly Africans, need. And I think most probably we've taken those type of issues for granted, that, you know, health is in the hands of international organizations. But with the Bono initiatives, with, of course, Bill Gates and his huge amounts of money, you know, $1.5 billion, the new endowment from Warren Buffett, I mean, these are things that we really surprised by. We didn't anticipate this 10 years ago.
Is the nature of international diplomacy transforming, changing for good, or is this... We've been the subtext of what we've been talking about is this being on vogue right now celebrities. Is it fad? In other words, it's a question you ask in your book.
Yeah, and of course, conservatives in the United States are very keen on saying it is a fad. I think what it does, though, is it shows that the old debates about diplomacy are coming out in a new way. The old, you know, the old debate has always been whether you should have closed diplomacy or sort of an open diplomacy. And of course, Bono, Gates, and all the rest show that open diplomacy have, if some flaws, lots of potential to get issues out there and in a sense deal with global issues in a focused way that deals with global governance.
Well, it was a good answer, but you didn't answer my question. My question is, do you think that this is going to stay, or do you think it's a fad? Do you think that we're going to see more of this, and if the world has changed in terms of international diplomacy?
Well, I think where you see the trend is going to be, as I've quickly mentioned before, towards the South. There's a lot of sort of untapped potential. And of course, in countries that now have ambitions to rise to the top, India is a good example. India, of course, has a Bollywood, a huge potential in terms of literacy and in terms of skillful sort of unofficial diplomacy. You know, so you've got the sort of big Bs who are, you know, huge stars around the world. But at the same time, there's going to be younger Indians that are looking at Bono, looking at Bill Gates, both from the entrepreneurial side, but also, of course, from the entertainment side.
Having done the research you've done for this book, I'm curious if a celebrity, a Canadian celebrity, say, you know, well-known Canadian singer or author came to you and said, you know, Andrew, I really want to do something and I want to harness my celebrity to help the world. What do you recommend? What should I do? What's the most effective way I can do this? What would you say?
I'd say pick a niche in terms of diplomacy. And I think particularly from those type of individuals, I think what we find in Canada is that there's been other individuals that have captured some of that. Stephen Lewis on HIV/AIDS, you know, Suzuki on environmental issues. So most probably there's not the need in Canada to have a sort of overarching perspective on the world.
Interestingly, that's Bono's explanation when it was put to him, you know, why he hobnobbing with George W. Bush. He said, because I'm dealing with one issue. I'm not dealing with George W. Bush as a person and his ideology and everything he wants to do in the world. This is, I've got my issue and I'm going to talk to him about it. And if I can get access to him and talk to him about it, good for me.
And that's the other part of Bono I do, you know, like, because he sort of moves down the hierarchy. He's interested in George Bush, he's interested in Condoleezza Rice, but he's also interested in sort of the bureaucrats that really focus on, again, HIV/AIDS. And I think if you're going to see the positives of this type of activity, that's the technique. You can't just sort of deal with leaders and then sort of move off and wait for the next summit or whatever.
Before I let you go, there's just celebrity fodder in my head. I want to ask you questions about is there anyone in the world, any type of celebrity that before going into this project you had a certain opinion of, that researching, doing, having more of an idea of what they've actually done, you came away impressed by?
Well, Angelina Jolie, to use the obvious example, I mean, somebody like her, I would never have expected to have the status, but also the gravitas in this type of work. I mean, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, she was known for everything else except this type of activity. So it's probably she's the one that stands out as showing the capabilities of this type of activity.
Not something you hear too often. A fan of Angelina Jolie. I'm kidding.
Thanks for being here. Thanks, Jan. Pleasure to be here.
Andrew Cooper is the Associate Director of the Center for International Governance Innovation and a Professor of Political Science at the University of Waterloo. His book is called Celebrity Diplomacy, and it's published by Paradigm.
This is Q, the podcast. We're on CBC Radio 1 twice each weekday after local and regional noon programs, and again at 10 p.m., 10:30 in Newfoundland.
Caribou Records is the Yukon's only multi-artist record label, and launching careers is its stock in trade. Kim Barlow released her first 4 CDs on Caribou, including her Juno-nominated record Gingerbread. And the Cuban band Vaya Son traveled all the way to Whitehorse to record both its debut and sophomore albums with the label. Well, as winter sets in Whitehorse, Caribou Records is putting a freeze on new recordings. Founding partner David Petkovich has already gone back to work a full-time job as an environmental consultant. But today, he's taken a bit of time off to talk to me about the future of Caribou Records. Hello, David.
Hi, Jean.
So, even with Caribou's success stories, why is the label's future uncertain?
Well, in this new environment, the digital environment, we are not able to sell as many recordings as we have in the past. And I guess there was a bit of a lag between when the digital downloading came into play and when it's finally caught up with us. And it seems that it's finally caught up with us. I mean, the demographic that we target most of our music towards didn't jump onto the iTunes bandwagon, so to speak, as quickly as others. So,
which demographic would that be?
Well, let's say 30 plus. Not to say that our music isn't appealing to a younger audience, but in general, to the 30 plus market. And so they weren't as quick to go out and purchase iPods and start downloading as quickly, but now that seems to be happening.
I mean, one of the things that I know Caribou Records has done, I think anybody thinking about the Yukon can imagine that it's not necessarily easy to build a music career that you're going to take across Canada or across North America or around the world out of Whitehorse, out of Yukon. How hard is it for Yukon musicians to get heard and perform outside the territory? And what was Caribou Records, what have you wanted to provide to aid in that?
Well, initially, we set up the label without putting together, a detailed business plan. We just figured there's a need, and we were interested in setting up a record label. But we thought by allowing the local musicians, songwriters to develop recordings, that they would have an opportunity to reach a larger audience, that these recordings could get played in radio stations across the country and internationally. So that played out quite well in allowing musicians to be heard outside of the Yukon and develop an interest in their music such that they could develop tours, get invited to festivals, and reach that larger audience. So we played a pretty important role in that initially. And so now, but all the way along, Caribou was fairly marginal to begin with. I mean, in terms of being able to generate enough income to continue and produce the next recording and the next recording. But you always travel, hopefully, of course. Mm. And when digital downloading kicked in, that was enough of an impact for us to look at the numbers and decide that, well, we need to stand back for the time being rather than incurring a lot more debt.
And you can empirically tell that digital downloading has made the difference.
Well, our CD sales have dropped significantly for us. And I would attribute that in part to digital downloading, but not just that alone. Along with the digital downloading came a lot of articles and hype in the media with respect to digital downloading, suggesting that the CD format is basically dead. And I think in that message being broadcast to the consumer, a lot of them have just stopped buying CDs.
People have abandoned,
regardless of even using iPods or downloading themselves. They've just reduced the amount of number of CDs they purchase in general.
Give me some context for the music scene in the Yukon. I mean, obviously, I'm familiar with the Frostbite Festival and the Dawson City Festival. Great music festivals that happen up there, including Yukon artists. What is the music scene like in the Yukon these days?
Well, I think it's extremely dynamic, and it's growing, and it will continue to grow. We have a music industry association up here that has over 150 members, which might not seem like a large number for any given association, but considering that we only have 30,000 people living in the territory, that's quite phenomenal. Then there's also a lot of other musicians and artists and people involved in the industry that aren't necessarily members of that association. There's still 5 to 10 recordings put out every year by independent artists in the Yukon, and a number of them are touring across the country and attending music conferences. We had two artists featured at the Western Canada Music Awards recently. Mm-hmm. And there's also a real young audience that is developing and coming forward, and that they're going to take advantage of this digital revolution.
Well, how has it changed in terms of the artistic community and the music scene there from when, say, Caribou first started?
Well, when we first started, there had only been about 2 or 3 recordings that had been put out on the market, one by a local sort of country artist, fiddle player, and another by a roots ensemble. But there was very little in the way of actual recordings. CBC had done a couple of compilation recordings over the years that got worn out at the station up here. But there really wasn't the infrastructure for a singer-songwriter to produce a recording and get it distributed outside of the Yukon. So when Caribou came along, we helped develop some of that infrastructure that could allow an artist to reach a larger audience.
And to allow for an actual music scene to find fertile ground in the Yukon.
To develop, yes. Yeah, there was always a really great live scene in the Yukon, and the bars would typically want the artist to come in and play cover tunes. They weren't that interested in having people come in and play their original music. They didn't feel that would keep the audience sitting in their bar long into the evening.
So I guess the question becomes, a lot of the artists on Caribou had never recorded before they signed with you. What will happen to aspiring musicians if there isn't a local label in the Yukon? Or do you think that this new era means that it's online anyway, and therefore losing a record label is tough, but musicians will be able to get by putting up their music and having it the world experience it through cyberspace?
Yeah, I think it's gotten a lot easier for a musician to get their music out to a bigger audience. And the role of the record label is changing, and we're probably not as critical to that development of the artist as we were in the past. An artist can sit in a home studio, record some songs, even single songs, and get them uploaded and distributed to a global audience. I mean, when we first started out with Caribou, we had our recordings, we did find a national distributor, and we were able to get our recordings into a lot of stores across Canada. But if we wanted to go international, we had to spend money and go to international trade shows and try and negotiate individual distribution deals, you know, whether it be with Germany or Australia or the USA. Now you can go to an aggregator or a broker and get your songs uploaded to 150 different downloading sites, and your music is available anywhere in the world, any time of the day.
Having said this, you have been the only game in town, pretty much, and you've been the such a big part of the of developing, as you say, that music scene beyond just the live performance coming out of the Yukon. Do you worry about what happens to the Yukon music scene without Caribou Records?
No, I think the music scene has a lot of momentum behind it right now in Whitehorse and the Yukon, and it's going forward regardless of Caribou's fate. We do, you know, looking back, however, we did help develop some of the infrastructure that will allow it to carry forward by lobbying government to develop programs that artists could access to get funding to do a demo recording or to do a full-length recording or to get funding to do touring and to market their product once it was produced. So given that that infrastructure is now available to individual artists, it's not so important to have a label to get behind them and write those proposals and grant applications for them. They can do that themselves. Additionally, we also helped develop the Music Association, which is an excellent resource. They have their own office where an independent artist can go to and discuss what their goals are. And there's a resource there that of people that can direct them down the right path on how to where to get funding for a recording, where to get funding for marketing, and how to go about setting up a tour. So all that infrastructure is in place now, and I like to think that Caribou played a strong role in getting that set up.
You sound pretty comfortable, or at least accepting, of the fate of Caribou Records and of winding down the label. Is there any way you would consider keeping it going if an investor walked through the door tomorrow and said, okay, I want to put a bunch of money into this and revive the label?
Yeah, I think that's possible. I don't know if I would be the one that would continue in that role. However, in saying that, Caribou is still going to operate. We just are going to wind it down to a maintenance level because we still have our back catalog that we're distributing and selling online and as CDs in local stores and across Canada. And we also have available as a distribution network for artists that have new product that they want to still produce as a CD and get it out to stores. We're leaving that open for artists to come to us so we can continue to service them in that way. And as well as we still have a couple new recordings that we haven't finished releasing yet that we will get out in the market. We just aren't going to produce any new recordings for the time being.
Favorite moment so far in the evolution of Caribou Records?
Oh, there was many, many
pick one
great times along the way, but getting word back that one of our artists that we were working with received a Juno Award.
That'd be Kim Barlow.
Jerry Alford in the Medicine Beat at the time. And then also a number of our artists got nominated for a Juno. Those are always exciting times. And looking back, we really didn't develop this label with any visions of grandeur. We're not disappointed because we can look back and feel that we have accomplished quite a bit along the way. And with this paradigm shift in the music industry, we're happy to move forward with whatever future that entails.
It's good talking to you, David. Thanks for your gracious comments, and say hello to the great artistic community there in Whitehorse.
Okay, great. Thanks for your interest, Jan.
Bye-bye. David Petkovich is one of the founding partners of Caribou Records, the only multi-artist record label in the Yukon Territory. It is winding down its operations in terms of bringing on new artists. He spoke to us from Whitehorse. You've been listening to Q, the podcast. Hey, you can hear Q, the program, every weekday afternoon and evening on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite 137. I'm Gian Gomeshi. Thanks for listening.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.